Hello, Dr. Kubisa, it's a pleasure to have you. Hello.
Thank you, Virginie. Pleasure to be here.
So you are a former executive of three huge companies, Statoil, Rail Baltica, and now you're still in the supervisory board of Lavengro, which is a huge electricity provider in the Baltics and the Latvian electricity provider. And you speak today on your personal behalf, but I'm extremely interested in hearing what public value means to you with this really heavy corporate background.
Well, public value and what certainly your institution supports and seeks is something that is extremely difficult to define, and that is even more difficult to evaluate, calculate, and put into life, because everybody has a different opinion of what it is. No matter what tools have been provided to date, public value is something very fluid, let's put it this way. In my opinion, no matter what sort of multi-stakeholder position you are in around, if it's corporate impact on, you know, a country, a municipality, a location, whatever it is, or from an NGO point of view, the real question is, do we understand each other? For me, alpha and omega is actually transparency and accountability. And how you are able to live in a forever changing world in a transparent and straightforward manner. We see that the big challenges of our times, which is on one hand climate catastrophe, and on the other hand, a massive technological revolution that is changing the way we perceive anything, make decisions on anything, is difficult to grasp, whether you're in government or in the corporate world. So the question is, can something like public value or a discussion around what it is bring benefit to the stakeholders that are involved in that dialogue?
That's really well put. Thank you, Baibai. There is a huge issue with measurement. Fully agree. And the definition of what public value is. And this is one of the reasons why we're asking representatives from corporations, regulators, et cetera, what they think this should be. So the debate is here. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't continue to support it. Because what the UN has tried to do with the Sustainable Development Goals was also to demonstrate that business can become a force for good, that's the UN slogan, and can continue to make profit while it shapes differently our planet.
You know, the three companies that you just mentioned, which are, you know, but of the few that I've dealt with, but the ones I've dealt with the longest, they are very different businesses, whether it's oil and gas, infrastructure, you know, or electricity. But at the end of the day, they all have a very strong, let's say governmental component, and they impact massive amounts of society. I think that public impact, it is a dilemma every time I've been at, you know, an executive table, so to speak, as to what is it that you really will or will not contribute, because there's always a catch-22 between being a profitable business, not outrageously profitable, but whatever profitable may mean, however it's defined, and being, I'd say, a responsible business, and everything in between. And if you're a state-owned enterprise, it's even more difficult. Because state-owned enterprises are subject to the vagaries of political change therefore, you know, long-term, I would say long-term planning is very, very challenging. So the question is, can one establish within a society? I know how difficult it is in Latvia itself, which is not a small country, but it is, you know, not a massive one either, how hard it is to agree on values. And therefore, how do you then calculate or articulate what is public value? And I think for public value, you have to go through Maslow's theories, and depending on where the society is, you are able, either as a you know, company or a government or whatever, to contribute to public value. At the end of the day, we should all be well fed. Energy should be sustainable and accessible. We should not be living in poverty. We should not have anybody living in poverty. And we should have clean air, clean water, and clean earth. Now, how to manage that, you know, is the ultimate question.
But it's quite important if we go to oil and gas, and really, I know you cannot absolutely speak on behalf of the former company where you live, but it's a company that has a pretty good reputation compared sure. to others. So if we take a company that really cares about its sustainable impact, what is important beyond the environmental impact? How can they articulate some kind of public value?
Well, I'd say don't underestimate the environmental impact in and how you define that. Because usually when you talk about environmental impact, you're looking at waste, you're looking at, you know, something that is negative. Any environmental company, or for that matter, companies that deal with utilities or infrastructure, all have impact on the air we breathe, you know, the water we drink, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, Statoil, I find it very intriguing how they've made the journey from when I was there to as an oil and gas company to become an energy company, you know, and move away from oil and gas. The other parts are certainly about, I'd say, having respect and engagement with the societies that you impact. With oil and gas upstream, in any case, you're looking at large oil fields, gas fields, or for that matter, you know, if you look through the lens of EITI, how mineral extraction, any mineral extraction, impacts on the societies where they are. And that is a question of standards of living, what wages you pay, how safe the workers, and even more importantly, I'd say subcontractors. I think that the greatest myth or the great unknown factor is how do you work down a supply chain? When you go down supply chains, you ultimately face corruption or different interpretations of what anybody believes the standard of whatever, you know, to be. I've seen that all the time and I see it still today. So I think that is one that one can certainly continue working on, to hold companies and subcontractors and actually individuals responsible, because companies are not monolithic. They're not sort of this abstract thing. It is a group of people that are doing something for people, by the people, et cetera. So the question is, what standard do you want to raise and how do you hold people accountable to that over a long period of time?
Yeah, I never wanted to underestimate the climate impact, but I meant that it is so obvious for this type of companies that the focus is on how they impact the environment. And we tend to forget society, but it's very present in your discourse. The other thing I hear quite a lot in what you're saying is accountability.
Yes.
And even transparency. These are two concepts that have evolved in the past few years, particularly accountability. Can you tell me what you think about accountability and how you see it evolving?
I think that we live in a world of crisis of governance. And if you take a look, at least today from my vantage point, that is what I see most. You have on one hand OECD setting standards for governance, and on the other hand, you know, a lot of lip service being paid to it. But, you know, when push comes to shove, there are 1,001 interpretations of what governance means. And therefore, that is where accountability comes in. I find it still very troublesome that we have a society, let's call it in the West, at least in the European Union, also actually in North America, and some other countries, where petty criminals, you know, for small theft, are quite roundly, very very often, put in jail or punished in whichever way, whereas, you know, the infamous big banks can get away with anything. And this, of course, goes hand in hand with legislators and with the rule of law in whichever country you're in. So we are in a really big mix of people who should be responsible. Right now, we're also going into internet companies. I was just listening right now to lectures in NATO STRATCOM, Strategic Communication Conference, you know, on the challenges of artificial intelligence and how they will impact on us. And artificial intelligence means how your locomotives are going to be run in the future. It means, you know, anything that you will be using for robots, for financial services, for a myriad of things. And therefore, for me, accountability comes down to who's really responsible for what and according to which standard. And it's very difficult if you are living, for example, in the European Union that has one common directive, because everybody implements the directives differently in every single country. And then you have neighbors where it's a free-for-all. So, you know, how do you work with that? And accountability at the end of the day is also very connected to money. And most governments, most very large, I'd say company leaders in the broadest definition of the word, hate to use the word corruption, but corruption and the attitude in different societies towards corruption permeates anything that we can do. And when you're looking at public value, in any chart, the lower corruption is, and the lower sort of an understanding from all stakeholders in a society is towards, you know, having transparent, honest, constructive, socially responsible processes, the healthier and the wealthier the countries are and happier, you know, even the happiness indexes. So there is a connection there. So for me, accountability is about, do you let people get away, individuals and companies get away with being corrupt or borderline corrupt, for interpreting law the way they would like to have it, or bringing about, you know, winds of political change where it is, where it destroys societies, which we see today, for example, in the United States and Ontario.
Yes, absolutely. But you also mean that people, citizens, should take part in raising the level of accountability.
Sure, but this is very difficult, actually, yes, because the one part is you need awareness of it. And you need a societal acceptance. In the region that I live in the Baltic, you have an extremely high level of inequality in society. And when people are poor, you know, they really don't care a lot about the loftier ideas of accountability and all of that, not really understanding that that is really important so that a government has a tax base that actually will be paid, you know, into the budget that then can provide services for those that have a harder life, you know, in whichever way. So I think that it's difficult. And the question is, and I genuinely believe that only societies by now, societies that have, that are, let's say, wealthier, healthier, a little more stable, actually have a civil society environment that can adequately challenge governments most of the time, sometimes also corporates, but mainly governments, in how they behave.
Right, but this is where artificial intelligence can help. If we take blockchain, you can have input from a lot of different people. The question remains of the quality of input, of course.
Yeah, of course.
But it's a good tool to check the supply chains down to, you know, tier 6, 7. And to try to understand what really is going on at local level.
I don't know about that well enough. I've only had sort of two tiny little looks at what blockchain technologies can bring. I'm not so sure they're mature at all today. They have a certain level of maturity. You know, they're boys playing around with blockchain kind of a thing. Let's see where it goes. It's like boys were playing with Facebook and Google, and here we are. But but hopefully those kinds of technologies and processes can illuminate more connections, especially as we are so connected globally, whether we like it or not. But you know, possibly blockchain is a technology that can assist.
But wherever technology takes us, what will remain always are the quality of input and the values that are used. So here we still have to fight to make sure that values are properly heard. If I go back to infrastructure, and building infrastructure everywhere around the world is always done on behalf of society.
Sure.
But is society really kept in mind during the construction work or during the process? Is it something that is really important?
Well, I think the Germans would say "Jein," a yes and a no. And it very much depends on the country. And it very much depends on the process. Infrastructure, to a large extent, is about construction. If you're looking at infrastructure development, and you know, I think Transparency International a few years ago identified that the average level of corruption for the construction business in Europe is 17%. You know, we can extrapolate where it's higher, where it's lower, you know, elsewhere. Infrastructure should be an advantage to societies, especially the development of infrastructure, because the better it is, the faster it is, the less, the more sustainable it is, the healthier and better economies, and very often also societies. However, the challenge is that we live in an era of fast gratification, and therefore, all infrastructure projects are long by definition. They cannot happen quickly, with one exception, and I'll get back to that exception. And therefore, it takes a long time for people to see whether there is an advantage to the society or not. And very rarely do you have infrastructure projects that are in close proximities to people. You know, if it's middle of nowhere, sort of putting a tunnel through a mountain, that's one thing. But if you're building streets or new highways or whatever it is, it does impact on societies. So question is, how does it impact environmentally? What is the level of safety, et cetera, for those that are in construction work? Are they being properly paid, or is this, you know, under, is this a gray economy, which it often, very often is the way that the bid has been done with or without corruption? You know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And is what is actually being constructed of a quality that is future driven and the way that they are operated. So I could go, you know, down that long chain and see whether it's right or wrong. The one country that does infrastructure quickly is China. And China will come in to Hungary, to Africa, you know, to other places and say, we'll give you a turnkey project, which means I will come in, I will build it with my own employees. We will import the employees, we'll give it to you and you will pay us back for it. This is very simplistically put. Probably with very good engineering and very good technology. Not so sure if it is always the best way to have, let's say, a reciprocal economic engagement with China, and whether everybody understands the way that, you know, a clashing of business cultures and even just cultures and values.
Well, but when you build in Europe, I think you need to play and function with the European rules and laws.
Yeah, sure. But I can tell you, they are in every single country, they are interpreted a little bit differently.
Mm.
I think that we will still be seeing a lot of discussion around this, you know, in the years to come.
That's a bit scary and absolutely fascinating, Baiba. When you talk about infrastructure, very often you mention that it's a project in the long term.
Yeah.
And we really need to keep this distance and this perspective into consideration, which is not something that society is always able to do.
Yes.
So what is left is trust. you have to trust that it's going to be well done, and it's not always the case, I mean trust. So when you are working with big company, state-owned company, and working in supervisory board, what's your advice to continue to raise trust among population?
It's continuous communication. Don't lie, don't hide, it's continuous communication. Every single country is different on the issue of trust. Swedes are rather different from Lithuanians, you know, in the way that they handle any issues, let alone anything else. But where there is success is where there's a very open dialogue with societies. I'm very proud that the company on whose board I serve in Latvenergo is seen as, you know, gets awards all the time for its sustainability reports and for actually also for its governance mechanisms. And I think one of the reasons that this happens is that there's continuous open dialogue. There will always be bad news somewhere along the line. You know, things can never be 100% fantastic, but how do you deal with accidents? How do you deal with inequality? How do you deal with unfairness, or at least perceived unfairness, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's why actually Norwegian companies tend to be very admired, not only Statoil. First of all, they have in their law, a mandate to perform in a certain way towards human rights and CSR. So, you know, it already sets a standard that is different from anywhere else, to the best of my knowledge, in the world. And you have a society that is much more aligned on common values than, let's say, a society like Germany, or Austria, for that matter. So it's, things are not so simple. Dialogue is alpha and omega.
So dialogue is a two-way communication. Yes, you talk and you listen to. And how can you make sure that the way you listen to the population is integrated and that people are heard?
There are two parts to this. I think that very successful companies in this area, they have procedures and processes and whatever, you know, from having regular meetings to conferences to whatever, market research, whatever it is. There are lots of tools for that. Listen to your clients, you know, usually, or your stakeholders. The other one is deeply personal. You know, processes are never far away from individuals and their values and their behavior. Who are the people that are appointed to do anything or to have any level of responsibility? And there's, of course, always the professional knowledge, and then there's sort of the emotional intelligence and behavioral intelligence and history that needs to be understood for truly great performers. And I think where you see fantastic leadership in areas, especially that are, let's say, non-commercial in the business world, they are unique personalities that drive and have an understanding of a broad range of issues that go above and beyond a balance sheet. And those are the very successful companies.
So the tone from the top, as always.
As always. I think, you know, the older I get, the more I understand it really is important.
So that doesn't change.
No, you know, the one is what the tone is, and it's just as important what you don't do than what you do, you know, or do say or don't say is, you know, equally important.
You know, listening to you in these few past minutes, it occurred to me that although we keep saying the world is changing at very fast pace, and it's true, and sometimes we feel overwhelmed and it changes, what we've been discussing are really ongoing, almost eternal values. The tone from the top, trust, dialogue, listening, transparency, accountability, this has not changed.
I'd say that the headlines have not changed, but the content and quality of it has vastly changed. I think from when, let's say, even Transparency International got started to today, with all of its different permutations, it's gotten more concrete. There's a broader common understanding about what transparency is, especially when you overstep it. I think the same thing is around accountability. I think there certainly OECD plays a certain role. The United Nations tries to, but I don't think that they're terribly effective, but you know, good enough at least being guiding lights towards that. But we have also what I at least experience is massive generational change in companies and in institutions that have a different historical memory than, you know, of course it's with every generation, it's logical. But right now we see, I think, a very large change because the same words mean very different things. And they also have very different priorities. I think that, you know, the Fridays for Future, Greta Thunberg, like it or not, has articulated, it's always been out there, but has certainly articulated fear of certain things. Human rights and human rights discrimination is always a challenge, and each society goes through it differently. I live in an extremely conservative society at the end of the day, and you know, the knowledge of what our human rights are, what are human rights and how they are interpreted legally, or even more importantly, sort of in everyday life, is vastly different. You know, women's rights are still not adequately recognized and taken care of. I still think, even though I am, you know, a well-known woman leader in this neck of the woods, they're still underrepresented wherever we are. And we see the attack on freedom of speech. So question is, you know, how do we hold, for example, media companies accountable? How do we hold internet companies accountable? It's really hard because for the future, for everything that's already been achieved, we need to find a new either self-regulating system or understanding of what the very same values mean. So, you know, life is exciting and it's a journey. So you just have to continue on this adventurous journey with each of, you know, the parts that also, you know, public value stands for, and reinterpret it continuously.
That certainly is a journey, and public value implementation and creation as well.
Yeah.
So I'm very grateful for your time, Baiba. Thank you very much for sharing your views on accountability. on transparency, on public value. And I look forward to seeing you very soon.
Thank you very much, Virginie. Au revoir. Goodbye.